Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Good morning, Mark.
Hey, Francis, how are you?
I'm well. How are you this morning?
Very, very well.
I'm going to share with you on the air, because we didn't get a moment to speak before the show, but I'm going to share with you on the air an interesting phone call that I just had.
Okay.
And it speaks to a lot of what we're talking about. We talk about a lot. We talk about people in the restaurant business, the people that work for us, as much as we talk about food, because that's what restaurants are. They're where people come together and have a sense of community, hopefully, and eat food. And the people that work in restaurants are really interesting. But we were talking in the office just yesterday with our office manager about how the first generation of kids who, like, went out for a sport and everybody on the team got a medal, you know, and everybody was the winner.
Of course.
How American corporations are having trouble dealing with this group of
kids. You're right. We were talking about this yesterday. You have piqued my curiosity as to what your phone call was about, I have to say.
Well, I got a telephone call from, right before we came, I was in our office in the restaurant, from a gentleman who called because his daughter had applied for a job with us. And he was calling because she was told that we weren't going to make her an offer at this time, and I indeed looked up her application, and she had gone through one of the interviews, and she had the application had been done what we call put on hold, which is in the I think I have better candidates right now, but it's called hold for future consideration.
Okay.
So she's in the hold for future consideration folder, and this is her father who called on the phone and said, you know, my daughter really wants to work there, and she's a good Christian girl, and you should consider her, and I want you to know, as a concerned parent, I'm calling. And I said, sir, how would you have reacted to that?
Here's what I would have thought. Let's see, she's not calling on her own behalf.
These are adults. These are people in their 19, 20, 21 years old.
Her father is calling for her to tell me how good she's going to be at her job. I would say, what a smashingly wonderful decision I made not hiring her.
You know what? I actually said, sir, you know what, sir? I think this call's inappropriate. And I said, what do you mean?
You were right, by the way. The call was inappropriate.
He said, I'm just a concerned father. I said, I understand, but you're a concerned father of an adult daughter. Now, look, if your kid was 16 and she's applying for a job at the Sandwich Mart or whatever, I'd kill my father if he ever tried to do that. But, you know, that's one thing. Or if, you know, this is summer camp or school or high school or junior high. But
You know what my father would have done?
What?
He would have thrown me back into the restaurant and said, go find out why you didn't get a job. That's what my father would have done. And I'd go back in and say, I'm here to find out why I didn't get a job. Why? It's all my idea.
This conversation floored me, and this has happened more than once, things like this, someone's parents getting involved.
Uh-huh.
And I said to him, I said, you know, sir, this is actually a professional environment. We hire adults. I don't hire children. And I said to him, I said, there are some restaurants that hire kids. You know, Burger King hires a high school senior to do whatever. This isn't that. This is a professional environment, and I don't want anybody on staff whose parent would ever call me about anything. You know, I said, you know, what happens if she comes and it doesn't work out and I have criticism for her and I discipline her? Are you going to call me? He said, I would never do anything like that. I would never get involved like that. I said, well, you are.
You are. You've already done it.
Well, he said, I didn't mean for this conversation to go this way. I said, look, I'm only being straight up with you because that's the kind of guy I am. Management 101 says, thank you very much for the call. I hang up the phone.
Bye-bye. And then I mock you on the radio later.
But, at least I gave him a fair warning. No, but I'm not mocking him. What I'm saying is there's a generation of parents and kids out there who I don't understand why you can't make that jump to adult, and your adult child now has to do certain things on their own.
Well, I think that we are constantly looking at the children of today and saying, oh, they play video games. Oh, this is their outlet. They have attention deficit. They have all, and we make a lot of excuses for our children, but I think that part of us making all those excuses for our children are causing our children to be the way that they are. We're causing this generation to act the way it does.
Well, and I mean, I think if...
And that's people my age. I'm talking about people and parents like me.
And I think if the gentleman had thought it through, I said to him, sir, I have 78 employees. If I had 150 parents that called me every once in a while, I don't. That's just totally inappropriate.
It's
I don't
want to
hear from your
too.
Girlfriend. I don't want to hear from your wife. I don't want to hear from your boyfriend.
Right.
And I certainly don't want to hear
from
your parents.
Actually, that's not true. I want to hear from your girlfriend or your parents to call me and say they were in a car accident and they're hurt very badly.
And we need you to come. Like emergency phone calls.
Exactly.
No, but I mean, I don't want to hear about your – I don't want to discuss your job performance or your application process with your parent.
Right.
I thought it was crazy. And what I thought was crazier – was I decided to be straight up with this guy because he seemed like a nice guy.
Right.
You know?
I'm sure he was a nice guy. Very concerned parent.
Oh, yeah, sure. But he didn't get it. He didn't. He's like, well, I'm sorry you feel that way, and I'm just a concerned parent. And I said, well, first of all, she's a good Christian girl. I'm like, how do you know I'm not Jewish? Why
right.
am I, like, what are you talking about?
Right,
first
right,
of
absolutely.
All, if I even acknowledge that I consider
that. That I care about that.
Yeah, I mean, I can't consider that.
Right.
What are you talking about? You know? So that's number one. But number two, she's a Christian girl. Well, then I'll hire her. I mean, come on. I can't. That's stupid. All right. So, but then. But
well, it's
then
ignorant.
Also,
I don't know that it's stupid.
Well, it's illegal is
right.
what it is.
It is illegal.
And rightly
that's
so.
Absolutely right. Of course.
So, actually, what our office manager said was, yeah, well, I'm a hardworking atheist. And what does that mean? It was funny. But, you know, and what he said was, he said, well, I hope this hasn't negatively impacted her application. I said, actually, sir, it has. She was in the future consideration pile. I've pulled the application. I have no interest in hiring your daughter, and you've ruined it for her. And he said, well, I didn't intend for this phone call to have that consequence. I said, well, okay.
Right.
But I don't.
I didn't intend for not showing up for work for 2 weeks to have a negative consequence on me. But look at that. It did.
Well, but what I said to him was, I said, the reason I decided to take this phone call, and any management handbook would say, don't take the phone call. Don't answer the question. Just politely say thank you. Hang up and do what you're going to do. Is I said, you know, I, the reason I'm talking to you, the reason I'm fleshing this out for you is so that maybe you don't do it again. Because. Other employers are going to have the same reaction. They're just not going to tell you. They'll say, oh, well, thank you so much for calling, sir. It was lovely to hear from you. And they're going to take her application and throw it away, too. And, you know, I don't know if his daughter even knows he called.
Right.
You know, I mean, this is dangerous stuff. You know, and so I just thought that's something that I read about all the time, how parents are getting involved in their kids' college lives and calling professors and like, and it's the first time it happened to me that I was on the phone, and I couldn't believe how.
Well, we've had, I've had other people with, you know, a 20-year-old tell me, you know, my daughter can't work past 11 o'clock. What do you tell the parent? You say, well, then your daughter can't work here. And we had one woman work for us for a brief period of time who said, I need to check in with my mom every night at 11 o'clock.
And I said, well, you can't do that. You're working at 11 o'clock.
You're working.
My favorite.
It's a restaurant.
My favorite was the way we found that out one night is we're like running around like maniacs. The restaurant was full, all dining rooms, full bore. It was late December a few years back, and we were running around like crazy. And I myself am like zipping by the office on my way from one private party to another, and she's on the phone. And I was like, we'll call her Sally. I'm like, Sally, Sally. And she gives me puts a hold up the finger like
the,
1 minute.
The one finger, like, hold
and she's
on,
my
right
phone.
I'll be right with you.
And she's on my phone in my office, right? And I'm running around. And
doing her job.
And I said, Sally, what? And she looked at me like kind of disgusted, put her hand over the mouthpiece and said, it's my mom. And I said, tell your mom to get off my phone and get back to work. Anyway, we love family, we support family, but you got to have some boundaries.
You keep it out of the workplace.
All right, we're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. It's 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick. And today we're talking with America's newest Iron Chef, Michael Simon. He's one of America's leading chefs before Iron Chef. He's the owner of restaurants Lola and Lolita in Cleveland, and he's won the next Iron Chef competition.
Michael, welcome to the show.
Oh, thanks for having me, guys.
Wow, man, you're a newly minted Iron Chef. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it's pretty wild.
I got to ask, when the show first came on, Francis and I were kind of both, like, figured Tracy Desjardins would go very, very far in the competition, and there were a couple other people who we were very familiar with. Who were you worried about? When you walked in that room, who did you say, uh-oh, I better watch out for this guy or girl?
Well, you know, I, I was most the chefs that I was most familiar with were Tracy, Edelm, and John.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I knew everybody in the room, but those were the three that I knew prior to the show. You know, have done events with them and so forth. So those were the three that I really said, "Ooh, I got to watch for these guys." When Tracy got eliminated the first show, I almost fell over. You know, her and I are sitting there to get. You know, when we started, I'm thinking, okay, I'm one of the favorites, and now I'm sitting here about to get eliminated with the person who I think's another favorite. So, you know, that made it a little interesting. And then when Tracy got eliminated first, you know, then you just don't know. I mean, it really showed that any chef could have a bad day.
Mm-hmm. Well, that was a big turn right away, for sure.
And, absolutely.
And for our listeners, Tracy Desjardins was eliminated first in the competition. Tracy Desjardins is an accomplished chef with her own restaurants out in San Francisco, and we've been eating her food since she was at Rubicon years ago.
Yeah, she's spectacular.
But that brings up another point, Michael. I mean, you had eight people there. I mean, this isn't Top Chef. You had eight people there who were all accomplished chefs. You know?
I mean,
it was a different field of competition than most other, you know, shows or contests of the sort.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it was very, very, very intense competition. And I said this to people before. They said, "Well, what's the difference between Top Chef and Iron Chef?" And I said, "This is absolutely no disrespect to the people that were cooking on Top Chef, but most of the people on Top Chef work for the people at Iron Chef."
Yeah, there you go. You've already got your own restaurants. You already have your own reputation. You're already established and accomplished.
Right. So you know it's. And I think that's why, like a lot of people go, "Oh, there's not much, like, you know, bickering between the chefs and this and that," and, you know, but it's because there's eight people that are very accomplished here. It's not everybody's very secure in themselves and comfortable in their skin and, you know, and been doing it for, you know, like in my case, 23 years, and John's the same thing, Tracy even a little longer than that. You know, Aron's mom is one of the most celebrated Mexican chefs in the world. Mm-hmm. I mean, he grew up with food in his mouth, so... It was just a really amazing group of chefs.
And you've done lots of publicity and lots of public relations, and frankly, most of you have done TV at one time or another. So I think that you guys were more comfortable in front of the camera and sometimes more comfortable in your own skin than maybe some of the people who were just up-and-comers were.
Yeah, I already had a show on Food Network that failed.
That's a great way of looking at it.
I've been down this road. I'll tell you what, it's a really a different thing, though. I was, Bobby Flay called me yesterday just to check in to see how I was doing, and I'm like, you know, I'm starting to get the feeling there were a couple more viewers on this Next Iron Chef thing than on the Melting Pot.
Well, that was your show on TV Food Network. How long did that last?
We were on for like 2.5 seasons, and this was in the 90s, too, before Food Network was quite the beast it is now.
Right.
Mm-hmm. You know, in the time slot we used to be on, my running joke was, "Yeah, I'm huge in prisons and nursing homes." You know, that really have tied into that public. But I mean, the support has been just unbelievable throughout the show.
I think you don't really realize necessarily how many people might be watching a show like that or listening to a radio show until you're actually out in the public eye and confronted by it. But I'll tell you, I had a listener in the bar from Columbus, Ohio, just maybe about a week ago, you know, and he's really pulling for you, okay? He's really like, "Oh, you know, Michael Simon, he's a local guy. I got it, you know, we're rooting for him." You know, you got an entire state rooting for you, you know, much less a part of a country.
Yeah, it's wild. You know, I mean, we watched the final at Lolita, one of my restaurants, and Lolita was our first restaurant. It's been around for, I mean, and we've been in that location for about 11 years, and it's small. It's like 60 seats and 10 at the bar. Well, there were about 240 people in there.
Now, hold on a second. You signed a monster confidentiality agreement once the taping was done with this, right?
Yeah, myself, my wife, who's my one partner, my other partner, Doug, my agent Scott and my lawyer all had to sign a $1 million confidentiality agreement.
So you're watching the show in your restaurant, and none of the other people know how it's turned out?
Correct.
That must have been a great feeling to know that you won and you're watching the show.
You know, it was the strangest thing, though. I'm watching the show, and I'm a nervous wreck, and I keep, like, whispering in my wife's ear, keep telling Liz, I'm like, "Why the hell am I so nervous? I know that I win." You know? It was a rough day in Cleveland because, you know, on Saturday, Ohio State loses. Sunday, the Browns are kicking the crap out of Pittsburgh, and then they end up losing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and it's kind of a very loyal town like that. And, you know, and we've kind of known as a town that's been jinxed. And, you know, I'm almost sitting there, I go, man, I hope they don't change the editing or something.
Well, fortunately, they didn't change the editing. And Michael Simon is America's newest Iron Chef.
There was no overtime.
We's just won the next Iron Chef competition. We'll be back in just a moment. 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:25.
Today we are proud to present Jackie Naylor.
Once upon a time, New Year's Eve was a night for swank jazz, champagne, and caviar. Put the swank back in New Year's Eve. With us, the Restaurant Guys present a New Year's Eve jazz concert at the Crossroads Theater starring Ms. Jackie Naylor. Jackie's been called the new voice of jazz by Vogue magazine. Jazz Times says, in the never-ending Next Big Thing sweepstakes, bet on Jackie Naylor. She's headlined internationally, she's played with Michael McDonald and David Sanborn, and on New Year's Eve, she'll play to a sold-out crowd at the Crossroads Theater right next to our restaurants. Dine before or after the show at either one of our acclaimed restaurants. There are hotel accommodations within walking distance, one of the best jazz singers in the country, two of the best restaurants in the state, and evening not to be forgotten. Go to stageleft.com or Catherine Lombardi.com for details, reservations, and menus, or call 732-828-4444. Put the swank back in New Year's Eve. Spend it with the Restaurant Guys. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to the Restaurant Guys. Margaret Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, and we're talking with the most recent addition to America's Iron Chefs, Michael Simon, who just won the next Iron Chef competition to become, well, one of the most important chefs in America.
Michael, you own two restaurants in Cleveland. You're now talking about being an Iron Chef and potentially opening some more restaurants here on the East Coast, correct?
We're looking at some different locations. You know, possibly Vegas or Atlantic City. You know, we're looking at a project in Detroit, which we were doing, to be honest with you, before the show. It certainly makes it easier to go into deals after the
sure.
show is complete because, you know, in Cleveland, I'm a household name. You know, in another city, that may not be the case. So, you know, I think all the chefs in this competition would feel the same way. You know, it's not like we need street cred, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, within the business, everyone, you know, all the chefs in the competition are very respected throughout the industry. But it certainly helps to be able to go to another market while you're on television.
Yeah, people know who you are.
Right.
You're a guy who spends a fair amount of time in your kitchen still.
Oh, yeah, every day.
How do you manage that when, okay, let's forget about other restaurants. Let's talk about just having to go to New York to do Iron Chef shows. How do you manage your time outside when you have to be outside your kitchens?
Well, you know, we're very fortunate in the sense that our employees really never leave us. I don't know. I think it has more to do with my wife than it does Doug and I. But they just stick around. So, I mean, my chef at Lolita's been with me 10 years. One of my chefs at Lola's been with me 16 years. You know, so for us, it all comes down to our staff. You know, if we didn't open our second restaurant until 9 years after we had opened the first, and and we certainly had opportunities to, but we just
sure.
really wanted to make sure that we had people in place that could do the job, and we grew correctly, and you know, we're really, really blessed with just having an extremely exceptional staff.
You know, we're going to take a break. We're going to take a break here and go to the news. But when we come back on the other side of the news, I want to talk more with you, Michael, about the people and how the people make an organization grow, especially in our industry. It's a hugely labor-intensive and people-centric business. And we're going to talk more about how that happens with America's latest Iron Chef, Michael Simon, after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back.
You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Capital Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Reach us through restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Michael Simon is the owner of Lola and Lolita Restaurants in Cleveland. He's had his own show on the Food Network, The Melting Pot, and he is the winner of the next Iron Chef competition, and he is America's most recent Iron Chef.
Michael, we were on you were on Iron Chef, and obviously a lot of your food is based in kind of Greek culture. On Iron Chef, we didn't see a ton of that. Were you trying to show people that you were kind of had expansive knowledge of all different kinds of cuisine?
Yeah, you know, at the restaurants at home, what we say we do is more of a heritage cuisine. And I guess by that, I mean, I grew up with my mother's Greek and Sicilian. My father is Eastern European. And I really grew up in a great, unbelievably fabulous food family. I mean, we always cooked at home. Everybody, the food was a very, very important part of my life and my childhood.
It's a huge advantage.
A huge advantage. You know, I mean, I was eating sweetbreads when I didn't even know what the hell they were.
Yeah, I understand.
And, you know, like, my grandpa laughs all the time. He goes, this nose-to-tail eating thing's so big. I was feeding you guys that when you were 6 years old.
It's right, hysterical. Right. That's right. True. You know, our parents were kind of smuggling that food into us and not telling it what it was, you know.
Yes. In the sauce, just eat it and shut up. So I wanted to show my range on Iron Chef. I think that, you know, American Iron Chef, I think, is different than the Japanese one in the sense that they say, you know, in the old Japan, the Japanese Iron Chef, they say, this is Iron Chef Japan, Iron Chef Italian, Iron Chef, you know, and I don't think that that's necessarily the case. I mean, I think everybody has a little bit of a style. Obviously, Mario is Italian, and Morimoto is a little bit more Japanese. Kat tends to be more Greek. Bobby tends to be more Southwestern. And I think we all have our styles, but I think everybody branches out of that style quite a bit throughout the show. So, you know, I wanted to show that, you know, I am versatile. I could do all these different things. I'm not. It's not just Greek or Italian or whatever. So it was a little bit of a conscious thought throughout the show. I mean, does my food lean towards the Mediterranean a little bit? Absolutely. But, again, I was trained by French and German chefs. So
but sure,
a lot of the technique comes from that.
And still you were using techniques like sous vide and lots of other, more cutting-edge techniques.
Right.
I want to take the conversation back to something we were talking about before the news. You were talking about how people don't leave you. You've had a chef who's worked for you for 10 years, another chef who's worked for you for 16 years. That's one of the hardest things in our business. We're sort of noted on our side for low turnover here in New York, we're in New Jersey, in the New York, New Jersey area. I think, is turnover greater in the coasts than it is in the Midwest? Is that one of the reasons you've had success? Talk to us about it.
You know, I think in this industry in general, the turnover is just immense. You know, I talk to chefs and restaurateurs all day, like, oh, God, I lost this person, I lost this person, I lost this person, and you know, it's one of those industries that turnover is just unbelievably high.
So how do you combat that? How do you keep your people? You said, you know, people don't quit when they go to work for you. And you know, another guy who says that very often, he doesn't say it quite as flat out, but he it's what he endeavors to do is Danny Meyer. He's like, I try my best to keep good people. What do you do to keep people working for you?
You know, I think that you know, I don't think it's like a secret. I think if you treat people how you want to be treated, more than likely they're going to stay. You know, I mean, we certainly get books that come in and you know, right out of the bat, they say, you know, I want to learn from you and then I want to move on. And we essentially make a verbal deal with them. Look, stay here for a year. We will teach you all that we know and we'll help place you at another restaurant once you're ready to move forward. But then, you know, our key people, we've always treated them the way that we want to be treated, and it becomes more of a family. A lot of people spend the holidays with us. You know, we have a lot of people that work for us that are transplants from other cities, and they'll be at our house for Thanksgiving, Christmas Eve, you know. And I think that's really the key. You know, I work for a lot of crazy French and German chefs that didn't think that way. And,
yeah.
and I just was like, man, when I open my own business, I am not going to treat an employee like a piece of garbage. You know, I'm going to treat them like a friend and a member of my family. And there's going to be days that I rip into them, but there's also going to be days that I give them a big hug, you know. And I think at the end of the day, that's the key. And that's why Danny Meyer is successful as he has, as he's been. You know, it's because people have been with him forever. You know, same with Mario. I mean, you look at Mario and Joe, and they've had people that have been with them forever and ever, and Bobby. And you could go on and on and on and on. And I think the people that have the most success in this business are the people that are able to keep those key people around for a long time.
You talk about prior job experiences, and I talk to Francis about this all the time. There are as many things I learned that I wanted to do working in other places. There are as many things that I learned that I didn't want to do when I was working in those other job experiences. And
you got to
take the whole picture and kind of bring your own frame of reference to it and build the thing that you want to build that takes elements and subtracts elements from other places that you've been.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think you've hit it so on the head. You learn as much what not to do as what to do. I mean, and at the end of the day, you got to do what you feel is right. And, you know, and every decision we always make, you know, it's not always about, like, we always, as business people, Liz Duncan and I always say, we'll always make the decision that's best for the restaurant. But at the end of the day, sometimes we make the decision that's best for the individual, you know,
mm-hmm.
best for an employee that may not have been the best decision for the restaurant, but it's been someone that's been with us for a long time. And sometimes you just got to bend the rules for certain people, I think, in certain situations.
And you know what I've learned? That always comes back to you.
Well, I agree. I mean, we're very passion-driven owners, not maybe number-driven owners so much. But, you know, at the end of the day, the businesses obviously work. They've been open for a long time, and that's how we run them, and that's how we'll continue to run them.
You know, what's funny is that sometimes, you know, to make an exception for a long-term employee who has your best interest at heart, maybe that is the best maybe it's not the best for the month end decision, but it's the best long term decision of the restaurant, is to have that person there and realizing it's a two way street and have a place to be.
I agree 100%. I agree 100%. I mean, it's like I was talking about my chefs, even our managers, most of our managers have all been with us over 10 years too, and it's because we made decisions that were best for the people. I mean, I stood next to some of my people through rehab and crazy stuff like that. And,
sure.
You know, and then they ended up being the greatest employees that we could ever imagine.
Yeah, welcome to the restaurant business.
You know what's funny? You know what's funny? And Michael, the three of us are probably smiling because those of you who work in, like, accounting and insurance and banking, like, wow, they had an employee that went through rehab and they... And I'm thinking, yeah.
I say I stood by his side. It was kind of good. I got some free tips on what not to do.
Well, what's funny is you said that, like, that's a crazy thing. Like, well, you know, even, and in most businesses it probably is, but in the restaurant business, you're like, listen, the restaurant business is a place where people come who are passion driven, and people who come who live in the night, and people who come who, you know, it's a catch for passionate people. And you know, sometimes, you know, we have to be a little more understanding to our people. And sometimes, you know, working in a great restaurant like yours, and hopefully ours is an environment like this, it can be a place that helps people, you know, exercise their passions and also stay on the straight and narrow.
I think another thing that you need to do in order to keep people long term, and I'm curious to get your take on this, Michael. One of the things that Francis and I do and work really hard to do is move people up through our organization rather than hire somebody from outside and put them in the top positions. Talk about how to engender loyalty and how to, you know, set appropriate expectations. It's been a much easier way to run my business. How about you?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, we have most of our key people have grown through the business with us. One of my chefs, Derek Clayton, right now, is someone who started with us about 2 years ago, but came from a friend's restaurant, so we were very familiar with him. Him and my pastry chef are really the only ones that we ever brought in from the outside.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody else, managers, chefs included, have like Frank Rogers, who I said has been with me almost 16 years now. When I was a sous chef in Cleveland, he was my dishwasher.
Right.
And then I brought him on the line with me, and then I took a chef job at another restaurant. I brought him as a cook, and then he became my sous chef. And then when the original Lola opened almost 11 years ago, he was the chef there, you know. So, and Matt Harlan, my chef at Lolita, started, you know, he was a busser, and then we're like, boy, he's a horrible busser, but I think he'd be good in the kitchen, so.
Yeah, you know? That's funny.
So he was a cook, and then he was with us for 4 years, and I sent him off to work with Thomas Keller at French Laundry for a year, and then he came back, and now he's an executive chef at one of my restaurants.
Our
managers were our bartenders, you know, it just, it's, you know, you build a relationship with these people and a trust, and they understand how you go about your day-to-day business, and in the long term, I think it's the only way to really do it.
The world has changed, and I think corporate America maybe could take a lesson from, you know, the mom and pops of the restaurant world here, and maybe what you should be doing is looking inside your own organization instead of trying to capture people from other organizations and giving them big raises, and maybe if you treated your own employees like that, they would continue with you.
Yeah, I think when you show an employee that kind of loyalty, they show it back, and I think it also. It resonates through the rest of the staff, too. Like, people that come aboard and they go, man, this guy worked all the way through, and look, now he's the boss. Mm-hmm. I could be that person,
yep.
You know?
Well, and it also gives people, when you're in a position of authority, it gives you an understanding of the people that you need to supervise. Hey, listen, we need to take a break for a commercial. We'll be back in just a moment talking with America's most recent Iron Chef, Michael Simon. WCTC 1450, the time is 11:47.
I think it's great that more and more restaurants are offering larger selections of wine by the glass. Unfortunately, I often find those by the glass wines flat or spoiled. It's been my experience that most wine preservation systems just don't work until now. The Vinfinity system was invented by Armando Luis, a mechanical engineer with over 25 years experience in the wine industry. Vinfinity has 3 U.S. patents, but it's so simple I could kill myself for not inventing it first. Vinfinity creates a precise vacuum in the bottle that preserves the wine. Too much vacuum or too little and the wine is damaged. Vinfinity never needs gas and requires little maintenance. One Vinfinity system preserves any number of wines. We use just one system for both of our restaurants, and we're not alone. Some of the best restaurants in the country are taking on the Vinfinity system. The guest gets a large selection of wines by the glass in great condition, and the restaurant eliminates waste. Tell your favorite restaurant about it. If you own a restaurant, install it. Find out more at VinfinitySystem.com or call 201-988-5953.
Hey everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're talking with America's most recent Iron Chef, Michael Simon. We were talking about sort of the business culture of restaurants, and I think part of the advantage that you have out there's a rumor that, and I can't verify it, but I know a number of people who work from that Danny Meyer, who owns Union Square Cafe and Gramercy Tavern and Tabla in New York City, is with other restaurants as well. When he opened his first restaurant, which was Union Square Cafe in New York, he hired only people from the Midwest. And he said it's because they're nice, and I don't have to teach them to be nice. and I thought that was really interesting. Now you're out in the Midwest. Is everyone nice out there?
No. But you know what? I think in general everybody's nicer, and we do have tons and tons of nice people. You know, it's a little different. People in the Midwest just are a little more easygoing, not quite as cutthroat, you know, and just have a natural. Easy, nice demeanor to them.
I think people don't realize how many of them I'm just weeding out for nice when I interview them.
You know, it's funny. We did bring in one guy who's coming in pretty much as a server, which doesn't usually happen. We have the great luxury of being in a university town. So a lot of our captains and our maitre d's and our sommelier, who's a certified specialist in wine, going to be a master sommelier, started with us as bussers when they were freshmen in college, you know. And so it's about keeping those people in-house. But I hired a guy as a waiter recently, something we rarely do, and he had great experience. He was from the Midwest. Wisconsin, was he from? They all run together out there in the middle. I don't know where they are. But he has a different job that brought him, like, during the day here. And what he said was, you know, I'm new to the area, and I like the restaurant business, and I'm looking to join a restaurant family. And this guy really had it. Like, he had the skills, he had the knowledge, but he also got it. And it was that sense of, like you said before, joining a – it's a sense of – it's a family in a way. Isn't it weird?
It is. It's so weird. And, you know, it's funny. Like, Liz and I and Doug, we always preach to the staff. Like, when we bring a new employee on, or we preach to the staff all the time, it's like, to me, the key to service is making people feel at home and happy, you know. And you could be the greatest server in the world, but if you're a jerk, the customer doesn't, they can't connect with you and they don't care. You know, if you're arrogant and you have this air about you, like, I'm better than you, it's all irrelevant at that point. You know, I mean, I think servers need to have the technical aspect of service down for certain. But at the end of the day, if they're nice people and good to their customers, the customers are going to always veer towards the server who's friendly, more towards even the server that may be technically better than them.
Well, I can, you know, and I tell people this all the time. I can teach you about food, and I can teach you about wine, and I can tell you, I can teach you about the syntax of the restaurant and what comes before what, and you know, how you're supposed to present the cheese board. What I can't teach you is how to be nice. I can't teach it.
It's you either have it or you don't. You know, people are either nice or they're not nice. And you know, it rolls over to us even in the kitchen. It's like we talk about it with my team in the kitchen all the time. A person could have the greatest resume in the world, but to me, they immediately, I know if they're going to work or not work in my kitchen. And it, a lot of times it doesn't even, I could teach anybody how to cook.
Mm-hmm.
But if you don't have, you know, that light confidence and air confidence, but that friendliness about you, you are not going to survive in my kitchen.
Right.
It's just, at the end of the day, that's the bottom line.
Well, and you know, something that arises in many kitchens, that's sort of a stereotype, which is too often true, but I think that great chefs and restaurateurs are trying to beat that down, is this divide between front of the house people and back of the house people, that's kitchen people and people who work on the dining room floor. You tend to get different personality types attracted to those two different positions. But that can often lead to a division in a restaurant, which was the stereotype for many years, and there was a lack of respect that went on between those two kinds of people.
We fight. I mean, we're always working, you know, with that, too. It's funny because in from a partnership, you know, my wife's a sommelier, I'm a chef. Our other partner is also a great front-of-the-house guy. He came from the Let Us Entertain You in Chicago and helps us, you know, helps with the books and the paperwork and that kind of stuff. So there's a very natural connection between the partners. But we always have to preach to the kitchen in the front of the house. Like this, we're one unit. If we don't succeed as a unit, we do not succeed.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of it I think has to do with sometimes, you know, a kitchen guy's going to work 70, 75, 80 hours a week sometimes and make half as much money as the server. And, you know, so I think that's sometimes what creates a little bit of that friction there. But I've said it to some of my cooks before. I'm like, no one's telling you you can't be a server.
Right, right. Exactly.
You know, I want to, when we come back from the break, I want to talk to Michael about two things. I want to talk to him about the difference between front and back, and I want to talk to him about what it was like being on the most important Iron Chef show of all time.
Hey, we'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 11:55. Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're talking with America's most recent addition to the League of Iron Chefs, Michael Simon.
Michael, you were on Iron Chef, and some of the viewers might not have realized exactly how much pressure there was on you. This was the most important episode of Iron Chef of all time. Never in the history of Iron Chef was there an opportunity for the loser to go home and the winner to become the actual next Iron Chef. Was that a lot of extra pressure for you?
Yeah, it was absolutely intense. I mean, at the end of the day, you know, one wins, one goes home, and the one that wins gets to continue on to be an actual Iron Chef. So, yeah, the pressure was extremely, extremely intense.
You know, and this isn't just like your typical job interview. This is you get to be Iron Chef and be on national TV forever. Well,
yeah,
for as long as it lasts.
Yeah, forever yep. and ever.
I was going to say, they thought that about Lost in Space, too, but eventually it went out.
But reruns are still on, so, you know, you can be in reruns for all time.
God, am I going to be fat and bald at the end of forever? it's a tremendous honor. It was a lot of pressure, but you almost have to... The nice thing about it is the greatest thing about competing on Iron Chef to me is they say, you know, La Cuisine, and all of a sudden you're doing what you do every day of your life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, this is what I do. This is how I cook. This is, you know, it's food. This is what it's all about. Now, granted, you're at a more frantic pace. You got to get a lot of stuff done. There's things that you can't do because you're time restricted. But at the end of the day, it's just me being a chef cooking food.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's the magic of the show. It's that it allows chefs to do television, but just be a chef. And it's the only show that's like that. Any other cooking show talks about food, talks about all these things that have to do with food, but it's never a chef being a chef. Only
right.
Iron Chef is a chef being a chef.
Well, we talked earlier about the difference between front of house and back of house and how maybe things are turned upside down on their heads a little bit. Back in the day, 20, 30, 40 years ago, a lot of the chefs, certainly in this country, were guys who didn't have education necessarily after high school, certainly in their field. You know, maybe they were apprentices, maybe they were tradesmen. And chefs were more tradesmen, where now there are, you go in, and chefs do have that extra education that they never had before. And I think also, back 30, 40 years ago, again, certainly in this country, waiters were more transient. It was a job they were doing until they were ready to do whatever real job they were gonna do. And now what you see is chefs are trained culinarily and they're trained professionally and many of them go to school to become chefs. And waiters and maitre d's and sommeliers are now trained to become professionals and not transients. And I think that's helping to knock down that barrier that we were talking about earlier.
Oh, absolutely. One of the funniest, when I was going through school and learning how to cook in New York, a chef that I worked for, who was from L.A. and then New York, his favorite joke was, you know what the difference between an actor is in Los Angeles and New York? And you'd go, what, chef? And he'd go, the actor in New York could carry 4 plates.
You know, it's funny. We talk about waiters, and because we do a lot of restaurant consulting in the nether regions of New Jersey, and somebody was talking who we brought in as a consultant from New York, who was working with us on putting this restaurant together. It was really hard to find staff. We're really blessed here in New Brunswick. We have Rutgers University here, 40,000 students to choose from, brings a whole new slew of people through the town all the time,
and intelligent people.
And so that's a real boon for us. But he said to me when we were out in the wilds of New Jersey, where the pickings to finding good staff are really hard. And he said, you know the difference between waiters here and waiters in New York is? I said, no. He said, you know, the waiters in New York may all be actors, but they're really good actors, and they can act like pretty good freaking waiters when they have to.
it's true, though. Being a chef has changed so much. I mean, I still consider myself a tradesman, and a lot of it might be because when I broke into the business, it was very different than it is now. There was no Food Network. There was, you know, no one went to culinary school to be a celebrity.
Mm-hmm.
You went to culinary school to learn a trade.
To learn your craft.
To learn your craft. And, but it definitely, the further we get along with it, the more, you know, most of the servers, 95% of the servers that work for us are professional servers. This is their livelihood. This is what they're going to do with their life. And they take it very seriously, and they're very, very good at what they do. Everybody in the kitchen, it's not a transient job for them. It's like this is their life commitment. This is what they want to become. So, you know, like you said, I think as time goes on, there's more and more of those people around, and it does help the relationship between the front and the back. And you have people that go to culinary school and then end up being just spectacular servers, too. They don't
exactly.
end up being chefs. So the level of professionalism in the business, I think, has gotten higher and higher and higher. The standards have gotten higher and higher and higher. I mean, even in New York, think of how many great restaurants there are in New York just compared to how many there were 15 years ago.
Yeah,
sure. Huge difference.
And that's the greatest restaurant city in the world.
Yeah, it's
fact. Not even in the United States, in the world. And,
well,
and look at how much it's increased there. I mean, other than New Jersey.
Yeah, right. I was going to say, next you anticipated my fate. next to New Brunswick, New Jersey, which pound for pound is pretty good for a small city. Anyway, Michael, thanks so much for coming to the show. It's been a pleasure to have you.
Thanks, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you got to check out. We'll see Michael again and again on national TV with the next Iron Chef. You know, I got to tell you, you reminded me of a story when we were talking with Michael about the how you learn as much from a restaurant that's going down as a restaurant that's coming up. And I recall that the restaurant you spoke of that you learned what not to do, it'll remain nameless. It's out of business. But you know, there's a silver lining to that cloud, because they went out of business because right before they failed, they got bought out by a utility company that wanted to put a big transformer where the restaurant was.
And gave them $5 million for their property.
You know what? It doesn't matter. If they had the best restaurant in the world, it would have been $5 million. They wanted that, the building. So, but what
sad,
they,
but true.
Do you remember the old bartender who used to work before you'd work?
Oh, yeah, I remember.
He was old and he didn't want to go down and get ice too much.
Uh-huh.
And so he'd stock up with ice in the beginning of the day and he wouldn't want to have to refill. And I would go there and I'd occasionally come visit you and I'd have a martini. And the martini was always slightly minty. And I remember I pointed that out to you once and you said, oh yeah, don't get the martinis when he's behind the bar. And the reason was because he would reuse the ice.
Yeah, he was tired. He didn't want to get more ice.
So, and there was a woman who would come in during the day and drink Stingers, which I've creamed him in. So the Stinger ice, we could throw him back on
so
the
ice. So if you had an up drink, he'd pour it off the off the ice and then put the ice back in the ice bin.
So I got a minty little martini. It actually wasn't half bad.
Great stuff.
Hopefully don't do that. Anyway, I hope you've enjoyed this slightly more than an hour listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascoe.
We are The Restaurant Guys, 1450 WCTC. The time is 12:05.